So how are things going? Alright. Any issues in recitation or any of that stuff? Is that going okay? We're doing something with circular motion. Try not to crack each other's heads. We'll see what I mean when we see it. Anyway, so we're starting to get into quantum mechanics. And the first semi-classical quantum mechanical theory. So it means the theory is a bit of a mix of quantum mechanics and classical theory. Came out in 1913. Niels Bohr put it through, and it's a model of the atom, and it's the first atomic model that actually was able to give a reasonable hypothesis as to why the spectra coming from different atoms is discrete. And in fact, that was sort of the goal that Bohr put in. It incorporated something that was pretty new in those days, which he picked up in Rutherford's lab, which was the fact that in the model of the atom, where you know you have some negative things, you know you have positive things, the positive things are pictured to be really tiny, sort of at the center. So most of the mass, because the protons that make up the nucleus are much more massive than the electrons. So this basically was understood. And so the idea was you put most of the positive charge in the mass, right, in the center of the atom, enormously smaller. I mean, on the order of 10 to the minus 15 meters in size, whereas the atom itself is more on the order of 10 to the minus 10 or something like that, so enormously smaller. And then you have the electrons somehow make up the rest of this atom. And then what Bohr did in order to put them, to sort of come up with this discrete model, was he treated the electrons as if they were particles. They're negative, you have a positive nucleus, so there's an attractive force toward the center, which supplies the force that keeps the electron moving in a circle in the same way the gravitational force supplies the force for planets to move in circles around the sun. The electrons, he literally assumed they move in circles, and you say, well, how in the world do you know that? Well, it's the simplest thing you would try. So you just try it and see if it works, okay? And, you know, in the older days, and I don't know to what extent this may have affected Bohr, I don't get the sense he had this issue. But in the old days, you might choose a circle because, you know, a circle is a special shape given to you by God or whatever. And there is a lot of that in cosmology in the early stages where the planets move on spheres. Well, why spheres? Because spheres are perfect. And if you were God, you certainly wouldn't, you know, make an egg shape, right? I mean, that would be perverse. So somehow the whole sense of what's beautiful comes into play. I don't think that's actually what broke Bohr, because the truth is mechanically it's the simplest shape you could use. And it's analytically very simple, and so you would use it. And it turns out that you get a pretty good answer using it. So there's no reason to become more sophisticated. It turned out that later on, the Bohr model itself pretty closely does give the spectral lines that we see in the hydrogen atom. It's not perfect, so people, one of the things people did in order to try to improve this agreement with data was to actually allow non-circular orbits and things like this. So, but the circles are sort of a core part of the initial state of the model. He allowed only discrete orbits, and this is what you mean. This is really where you input the quantization in the system. And in Bohr's day, this was a little bit ad hoc how he did it. I'd have to actually review the literature a little bit to remember how he motivated it. He actually motivated something we call angular momentum. That's what he actually quantized. About 10, 15 years later, when de Broglie came along, there was a much more conceptual way of thinking about it that sort of motivates this. But in the end, he allows only particular discrete orbits, and he says that they're stable. Now, it turns out that if I take the electric charge and I move it in a circle, it will radiate light. Because I'm basically having to accelerate. And it turns out the accelerated electric charge radiates. And so the truth is, if I have a model like this where I have a nucleus and I have an electron orbiting around it, the truth is because the electron is orbiting around it, classically it's going to radiate away some light, and as it does, it loses energy and it will spiral into the nucleus, which is really why nobody came up with such a model before, or one of the reasons. Classically, these orbits actually are not stable. Bohr said, let them be stable. It's just input into the model. And the reason he does it is because of what he ends up with in the end. But it classically makes no sense. So this is at the core of the quantization of his theory, basically saying certain discrete orbits, that is, certain discrete orbits in terms of their radius and their energy, are stable. Period. The reason that he did it was because he basically was saying, if I have these stable orbits, then these electrons can absorb light that's coming in if it happens to have just the energy that is the difference between those two orbitals. Or if the electron jumps from one orbital down to another that's lower in energy, it will emit light of just that energy. So it's a mechanism whereby light of very particular energies is emitted or absorbed. And that's what you see with these discrete spectra. You see light of very particular colors that's either absorbed or emitted. And so this gave him a mechanism to do that. And then the question is, can you come up with a scheme where you get energy differences such that it agrees with what you see experimentally? And amazingly, with this sort of simple model and the way in which he chose his quantization, he can get spectra that agree very closely to that of the hydrogen atom. And the hydrogen atom is particularly important because the hydrogen atom is made up of one proton and one electron, so it's the simplest thing out there. And so if you're going to say you're going to try to understand atomic structure, that's your starting place. Can you at least do that one? It turns out to be the mechanics of a two-body system is easy to calculate. You can put the nucleus here, say it's so heavy it doesn't move, have the electron go around, it moves in circles, and you can calculate that. It's not even annoying to calculate. It's not the spirit of this class, but I could drag you guys through it. It has nothing fancy in it. And you come up with something that's almost the right answer. If you go to the next more complicated atom, so you have a nucleus which is made of two protons and a couple of electrons, it doesn't matter. You have this nucleus and you have two electrons. So this would be helium. Then you have three bonds. And it turns out that even the greatest physicists in the world cannot exactly calculate a three-body problem. It's very complicated. You can use computers to simulate where things will be someday, but it turns out to be a hard problem. So, you know, you sort of start with what you think you can do, and that's what Bohr did. But it turns out that the hydrogen atom spectrum was well measured. You can take this simple picture and actually come up with something that works very well. At this point, you already have black body radiation, the photoelectric effect, pretty well understood. So the whole idea of having the light being absorbed or emitted in quanta wasn't so new in this. So it just took advantage of it. But I would say it was another, at this point, the spectra that the Bohr model predicted for hydrogen was close enough to the real thing that people would observe in the data that it was yet another piece of evidence in support of the fact that light is quantized as well. So one way to think about these different quantum orbits, I think I talked about this last time. After de Broglie came about and people began to think, well, maybe the electron is an actual wave, then your whole mental concept of what it is differs. So instead of thinking of the electron in the Bohr orbit being a BB sort of orbiting around the nucleus, you can think of it as a wave, and then you can ponder, well, if it's a wave, then if you have a wave that effectively moves in a circle, then you can imagine having waves with very particular wavelengths, such that if they move in a circle, as they go around, they basically interfere with themselves in a positive way, constructive way. And you'll get a circular standing wave, not so different from the kind of thing we had going back and forth in that demo. Whereas if you have a different wavelength, you may find that as it goes around, it interferes with itself destructively. And so you might argue that this is not going to actually be stable, but this will be stable. And it turns out that if you look at the energies and you use that to estimate the speed, and you basically associate that to the wavelength that you would expect, and then look at the radius and calculate basically which orbits ought to be stable, you basically do get the same quantization that Bohr came up with in 1912 without this picture. But to me, mentally, this is sort of a step further down the road of quantization, because you're now treating the electron as a wave. And it's sort of intuitively satisfying, because it makes some sense as to why you might expect some orbits to be stable and some not. And just to remind you a little, the motivation behind what Bohr was doing, if I take atoms and I heat them up and I split the light into its different colors, if I have lots of different atoms excited so that basically I get a continuum of light emitted, then I get this so-called continuous spectrum. So that's what we were seeing with our gradients a little while ago, Monday. If I take a very particular atomic gas and I look at it, so I don't have lots of different types of atoms contributing to it, or I don't have it basically coming off more as black body radiation than as atomic emissions, then when you split the light, what you find is only very particular colors that you see. So we saw this at the grating. And if I take a cold gas and I take white light behind it, then only those very particular frequencies will be absorbed. So the gas will absorb. So the gas will absorb or emit light at the same particular frequencies. And it is this discreteness that Bohr was really trying to get at with this model. Because it's clearly a very important characteristic about atoms. So there's some science telling us something about the structure. And classically, you really can't get it. If I think of the atom having, you know, sort of a positive mesh with negative things vibrating inside them, I'm not going to get this kind of discrete structure. So it's a very, if I allow the orbit to decay the way it would classically, again, it's going to emit a smear of light, or it would absorb a smear of energies instead of having these discrete. So this is really pretty bizarre, actually. And it really requires something quite revolutionary, which is what Bohr came up with. And you really can't see it very well. You probably still can't see it very well. This is white light. This is hydrogen, helium, something, and something else. I can't even read them. But you can maybe see the different line structure. And we saw that in the demo Monday, I think. So you've seen the fact that you get the different structures for the different atoms. And again, that's telling you something that you
you know, you need to understand if you want to think you understand atoms. So they are a fingerprint.
So let's think about it just for a moment. Let us suppose that we have in the Bohr model an atom, and in this particular atom, there are four orbits allowed. And we can calculate the energies, and we say that this atom has four orbits, each of which has a different energy. Now, if I took that atoms of that gas and I heated them up, how many spectral lines do you think you see? Any ideas? You can get a spectral line every time you could have an electron jump from one orbital to a lower energy orbital.
Three.
Okay, so you might imagine an electron jumping from E4 to E3, or E3 to E2, or E2 to E1. So that would be three different frequencies of light corresponding to these differences in energy. But it's a little more complicated than that, because you can jump from E4 down to E2 and E4 down to E1 as well. So just I'm just trying to give you a sense of the how you have predictive nature in this kind of model. So if you said this is what I've got, and you calculate, you know, I have four energy levels and I have these particular energies, then if you then heated up the atoms, or you had cold atoms and you sent a broad swath of continuous frequency light through the gas, you would see spectral lines, and those spectral lines would correspond to this energy difference, this energy difference, that energy difference, this energy difference, and that energy difference, and that energy difference. So you would actually see six spectral lines. And the model is very particular about what the frequencies of what colors of light would be emitted. It would be colors of light that correspond to the photon energies, the packets, which is equal to h nu, and nu would be the frequencies. So I could tell you what frequencies of light. I could tell you where along here it would show up. The photon energies would correspond to the differences in energies between these levels that we have to jump. Yeah.
Do these lines only show up like in the visible spectrum, or do they also show up?
They show up all over the place. And in fact, that's one of the things you would have to do, and Bohr did, is you calculate it, and you would find, for example, it does happen when you look at the hydrogen atom that, for example, the more energetic lines are in the ultraviolet, and we can't see it, and the least energetic lines are in the infrared. But there are a set of lines that show up in the visible. And you may read, when you do some of your reading, you may actually run across some of these names. But what you often will see are a series of lines, because you'll have, for example, you know, this one, and this one. It may be that all three of those will show up in the visible. In which case, what you'll see in the visible is sort of these three lines, and they'll differ in color, but usually they are discovered by some scientists. So there's the Balmer series, there's the Lyman series. So they actually come with particular names that spectroscopists know about. But it's very predictive. Okay, you have a certain structure of these orbitals allowed. The electrons can jump from one to another, and you'll get very particular colors coming off due to this. So it's a very I probably haven't mentioned, you can take this light with very fine gratings, and you can spread it way out, and you can make instruments that are extremely good, so you can measure the positions of these lines, or the frequencies of the light, to very high precision. In fact, I would argue that this type of stuff was amongst the most precise types of measurements that could be done in those days. And in fact, they would do it as good as you could do it today. And the spectroscopy, this ability to spread the light and measure these frequencies, was extremely well done in those days. So these were not... This wasn't the Stone Age for science or something. I mean, this was stuff they were really good at. So they knew where these frequency lines were. So the fact that you could then come up with this sort of ad hoc semi-classical model and come up with something that pretty closely gave you the right lines was really quite amazing. So the Bohr model, in fact, was very successful. But then we sort of have a problem, because the Bohr model really is not inherently a quantum mechanical model. The Bohr model has quantum mechanical elements, and it has classical elements. So quantum mechanically, you have this, I can only have certain discrete orbits. But the electron in the calculation is quite literally treated as a classical mass at some point. So you really don't have the wave part in it. Even to the extent that you buy into the fact that you might get these circular standing waves, and so perhaps you can treat the electron in a sense more wave-like in the 1920s, and sort of modify Bohr to be a bit more of a true quantum theory. And by true quantum theory, I really mean you now have to allow for the wave-like aspect of the matter to come into play. So sort of a true quantum theory somehow deals well with the particulate nature of waves like light and with the wave-like nature of the matter. There is sort of this other problem that's just completely not in Bohr model at all. And that is, if I have a proton, a positive proton sitting here, and I have an electron out here, this is a spherically symmetric problem. This electron, I mean, why in the world would it orbit in a plane necessarily? Because the attraction here is completely spherically symmetric. So that's sort of a weird thing. You do get some things in planetary systems, you do get orbiting in a plane. But that actually comes about because the stars and the planets are formed as a big gas clouds out in space collapse. As they collapse, you have what's known as angular momentum conservation, which if you've watched the Olympics, you saw a lot of a couple of weeks ago. If you're spinning, your mass distribution times your rate of spin happens to be a constant. So if I have lots of mass out here, we call it moment of inertia. That is, I have a large moment of inertia. My angular rate of spin is fairly small. As I bring the mass in, my angular rate of spin will speed up a whole lot because I'm reducing my so-called moment of inertia. Moment of inertia is really what you can think of as angular mass, in a sense. It can't quite be the same as normal mass because where you are relative to the axis makes a difference. It's a lot easier to open a door if you exert the force far from the axis here, okay? A lot harder to open it if you exert the same force here close to the axis. In fact, you can't even do it. So there, you know, where a force is located, and you know, big heavy doors are much harder to open than light doors. So how the mass is distributed and how mass is very important for trying to get angular acceleration instead of linear acceleration. There's a big analogy between the two. But at any rate, sort of conservation of angular momentum says that if I start out rotating with large moment of inertia, as I bring the mass in closer to the axis of rotation, I will speed up. And so you see skaters do this all the time, right? They'll always go into spin out like this. They'll speed way up, and then right before they stop, they'll throw their things out. Okay? And you'll see it with divers and all this kind of stuff. If you're a diver and you want to have more rotations, you want to have a tighter cup because the distribution of your mass is closer to the axis, so you rotate faster. So there's a lot of physics in this type of stuff. At any rate, if you have a gas cloud collapsing into planets, this game will sort of create the rotation all in one plane. And that plane will more or less be perpendicular to this axis of the initial axis of rotation of the cloud. But there's no real mechanism that you can imagine doing that for atoms. So it's really rather bizarre that you have this model that effectively looks at this orbit in a plane, and it works because it's a fully three-dimensional model. The other thing is the electron, it's not a string. So this idea of having sort of a one-dimensional standing wave moving in a circle is a little bit bizarre too. You actually have a fully three-dimensional system, so the electron wave shouldn't be so constrained as to be along some one degree. In addition to that, once you decide that massive particles might have wave-like characteristics, you have to actually develop the basic mechanics that allows you to solve for that system under different forces and different types of masses. And that just wasn't there. That just wasn't there. So people actually had to just invent them. And fortunately, in any given generation, there are a lot of really smart people. And so some of the really smart people stepped up and actually invented the mechanics that you needed to have waves that had mass and to develop mechanics that was consistent with sort of what de Broglie said. And that's really what we mean by when we say formal quantum mechanics. Here are two of the famous players. This is Werner Heisenberg, and this is Schrodinger. And they did their work sort of in the 20s. They got Nobel Prizes in the early stage of the 30s for their work. These two guys, this guy's name is Max Born. These guys basically invented quantum mechanics. There were, Heisenberg worked with these. They actually invented it twice with different mathematics. In Heisenberg's case, I don't know if you've ever run into matrices before, but he had sort of a matrix algebra that he used, and it wasn't very intuitive. Schrodinger actually developed a wave equation that was more intuitive. So when I was in graduate school, for example, I learned how to calculate things with Schrodinger's approach, and that sort of guided my intuition. But it was figured out that basically these were different ways of saying the same thing in time. Just as an aside, this guy Max Born, we'll run into him again and again. He was one of the founders of quantum mechanics. And I don't know if you ever, you may not have had any reason to know him, but we have an ancient fella in physics who these days walks about this fast. He's still active, and he's around. His name is Emil Wolf. And Emil Wolf and Max Born are collaborators and wrote one of the most famous optics textbooks that's out there, quantum optics. So, even now we have locally somebody who grew up working with Max Born. I think actually it was Max Born's granddaughter. I forget the exact connection. It may be in my book. It's Olivia Newton-John. So, if you go in physics, a few years ago, Ari Bodek was chair of the department, and one of the things he did was he decided that we needed to publicize our awards and things more. So if you go into the vestibule of Boston Lung, and you look around, you see all these ridiculous awards or copies of awards sitting around from some of the various faculty. And then you'll see a signed photograph from Olivia Newton-John, to him over the while. Collaborating with Max Born, whose granddaughter was this famous Australian singer.
So I put up one version of Schrodinger's equation here just so you've seen it. And this symbol psi is sort of a mathematical representation of the wave of the particle. And in this particular form, I guess it's not time dependent, but here's sort of a spatial dependence. And one of the things that you have in this is that there's this thing V that's in here. And that V really represents whatever force that you have on this particle. So in the case of an atom, you would want to put a positive charge here, and you'd want a spherically symmetric Coulomb force on that electron. And you would mathematically put that form of the force basically right here, and then you would solve. You could imagine having very different systems. You could imagine having an electron going between two parallel plates where it has just an electric field in that region, so there would just be a constant force somewhere. And that would be a different mathematical expression that goes here, and when you solve it, you would get a different set of solutions. So this turns out to be the general case. No matter what kind of force I want to put the particle in, I can describe that force, put it in here, and then effectively solve this. It's not always soluble. So sometimes you have to, I mean, even these days, you have to use computers to sort of calculate it, but it can, in principle, be solved. But at the time, the big thing that you would want to do with this in order to see if it makes any sense is you want to select a system where the wavelength characteristics are critical, and you think that's true for electrons, so that would be true if you want to understand an atom, and then you would want to choose the simplest atom, and then you want to see if you could use this and do anything as good as Bohr, right? And you'd hope you could do better. So this is really what they did. So they took this framework and they put in for that V, basically, the physical situation where I have a positive proton. And then I imagine that I have sort of a spherically symmetric system. But a fully three-dimensional system that now has full spherical symmetry. That is, at the same radius, it doesn't matter where, what angle this electron is, it'll feel the same force toward the center. Okay. And you may run into this in some of the reading. If I put this particle in a situation where it feels a force in a spherically symmetric way, the way physicists say that is they say you put the particle in a spherically symmetric potential. So we usually actually operate in a way that looks at changes in energy. And so we talk about changes in potential energy. And a way to think about that, for example, would be if I had a book and I had it very close to my foot and I dropped it, it's not going to smash my foot very much. So a way to think about it is it doesn't have much potential energy in it. As I lift it up, it now, I say, has a lot of potential energy because if I now drop it, it's going to smash my foot. So one can talk about, instead of sort of this spherically symmetric gravitational force down in the center of Earth, you can talk about spherically symmetric changes in potential energy as I raise something up from the center of the Earth. And when you map that out mathematically, we call that the potential function. And so the lingo is, I'm telling you this in part because I'll slip up and use it, but you also may read it in some of your reading. When we talk about putting something in a potential, we're really talking about putting it in a situation where there's a certain type of force on it.
And so a spherically symmetric potential would be one where you have a spherically symmetric force on the object. So, and V is a symbol for potential, which is why it was in that equation. But in the end, what you're really doing is you're setting up the mathematics where you put this spherically symmetric situation in place. And you put it in Schrodinger's equation, and you solve it. It turns out these kinds of things are not always soluble. Certainly more problems are not soluble than are soluble. But one of the really cool things that makes the lives of your physics major friends in their junior or senior quantum mechanics class absolutely miserable for a few weeks is that this problem is absolutely and explicitly solvable. It is also absolutely and explicitly sort of nasty. So it's very miserable. But it can be solved exactly, mathematically. And when you do it, you get some pretty interesting things that come out of it. First of all, you find that only particular spatial, I'll call them orbitals. So similar to Bohr, only certain particularly spatial distributions are allowed, which these also correspond to particular energies. If you are worried, you can now breathe a sigh of relief, because you have to have at least this if you're going to do something similar to what Bohr did, right? You have to have something, it has to be discretized, otherwise you can't have the spectral lines. So you have these particular spatial orbitals, and these correspond to particular energies. A way to think about them is these are, we call them states in which the electron is allowed to exist. So, before I really show you what these things look like, I'll tell you a little bit more about that. So, we're going to talk a whole lot, actually all semester, but certainly a lot, maybe later today, certainly much more next Monday or so. In Newtonian physics, I can imagine putting an electron, or taking Earth, for example, around the Sun, and I can calculate exactly where it is. And I can tell you where it will be in 2,000 years. I can tell you where it will be in 2,000 years on October 13th at 5 in the morning. Right? It's deterministic. In quantum mechanics, the world is different. If you go to the beach and I say, okay, where's the wave? It's a much fuzzier problem. And it turns out that if you ask, what can I actually calculate in quantum mechanics? I actually cannot tell you where the electron is. I can tell you where it could be, which may be one of many different possible states, both spatially and energy-wise. And I can tell you the probability that it may be in a specific one. But even within it, I can't tell you where it is, And I can't really tell you for a specific case whether you're in this orbital, that orbital, this orbital, specifically. So quantum mechanics has a piece that is absolutely inherent to it, is uncertainty, some sort of fuzziness to it.
So let's look at what we actually can learn from this particular theory. So we could imagine, just to give you a feeling for this, so we could imagine going to a ski resort, and let's say that we have different chalets here. And we'll let, you know, this person be our electron. And if this person doesn't have much energy, then they're going to have to spend the night there. If they have a lot more energy, maybe they can climb up to here. If they have a lot more energy, they might make it here and spend the night. Okay? So in quantum mechanics world, I would call these different states of existence, in a sense. And these different states of existence where this person could spend the night correspond to different amounts of energy, if you want to think of it that way. If this person is in that state, I have no idea what room of the house is in. I just know it's in that state. I may, from quantum mechanics, be able to calculate a probability. I could imagine, for example, there's, you know, some reasonable probability through the course of the day that they'll be in the bedroom. I might be able to, okay, this person sleeps 8 hours a day, so I might be able to tell you what that probability is. But I can't tell you what room this person is in. If I have 1,000 mountains and you come by at night, I can't even tell you which of these houses specifically that this person would be in, but I can tell you, based on the demographics of people, roughly what fraction of people would stop and sleep in that house, what fraction of people would stop and sleep in that house, what fraction of people would stop in that house, sleep in that house. So if you integrate over 1,000 mountains, I can tell you roughly how many people slept in the lower house, the middle house, and the upper house. So I have some estimate of the probabilities. But show me a particular mountain, I have no way of knowing which house they're in. So that's sort of the fuzziness that you get with quantum mechanics. So I'm now going to sketch the probability density, which would be sort of the house map for one of the houses in the hydrogen atom. Hydrogen atom, we usually abbreviate as H atom, just so you know. So if I do this, if the electron is in the lowest energy state possible, we would call it the N equal 1 state, then it's spherically symmetric. And it has a probability density that sort of drops off as you go away, as you go out radially. If the electron is not in the ground state or the N equal 1 state or the lowest energy state, all of those mean the same thing, then the next highest energy state it could be in, we call the N equal 2 state. So that would be the next house up. And it would look something like this. There's a spherically symmetric central core where it might be found with some reasonably high probability. And then, oddly enough, there's some region which is further out It is also spherically symmetric, but it's a shell where you would have some reasonable probability of finding that electron. You would almost never find that electron out here or in the middle here. So it's an odd-shaped house, but that's what you get out of the quantum mechanics. That's what you find out about. So it's a complicated beast, and this is sort of a more professional drawing of the houses in which the electron and the hydrogen atom might be found. This is the N equal 2 house that I tried to draw. The brightness tells you the probability that you might find an electron there, and you're to try to imagine that these are sort of spherically symmetric. In fact, so what you'll notice is that quantum mechanics allows you to have a lot of different shapes of orbitals or houses. So you're not limited to this sort of circular thing that Bohr had. You get angular dependence that comes in, and this is part of the complication of the mathematics, but it's now no longer just in a plane as a circle. You now have very complicated angular shapes. And it turns out these have a whole lot to do for driving how chemistry works, how different atoms interact with one another. So these represent the possible states of existence for the electron, and each of them corresponds to different energies. Some of them actually may have the same energy. For example, these three all would have the same energy, but they actually are three different states in the solution, three different possibilities. For a given hydrogen atom, if I've cooled it as much as possible, I might be able to tell you that it's in a low energy state. But even if I knew it was in an N equal 2 state, for example, all I could tell you is what is the probability, this probability distribution. I couldn't actually tell you where in that region the electron is at all. I could not localize it any more than that. Talking a lot. You guys have any thoughts or questions, or is this getting across?
Why is it that
when they have different states they have the same energy? When you solve the thing, it turns out that when you write Schrodinger's equation in a spherically symmetric way for the hydrogen atom, at least, it turns out that you can actually split that up into three separate equations, one of which corresponds to the radial dependence, one of which corresponds to one of the angles, and another that corresponds to one of the other angles. And you can then solve each of those independently, but they're tied together a little bit. It's not, you did start with one equation, so they are tied together a little bit, but you can sort of solve them each independently. When you do that, it turns out that it's the piece, that the energy generally depends on the radial solution for the most part. And so as you go up in energy, you will have sort of the radial solution, which gives you one energy, but there may be more angular pieces that you have on that are different, but
they would all have the same energy because they have the sort of same radial component as a way of thinking about it. So I'm trying to give you a feeling for it. The other way to say it is just because when you solve the equation, it turns out that way at some level. That's I don't have a good reason for it. Within quantum mechanics, I mean, when you make this solution, some of these states just happen to have the same energy. We call them degenerate. And one of the things that's very exciting about this, actually, is that you can break the degeneracy in some of these states, that is, take states that are normally at the same energy and change those energies by putting in a magnetic field, for example. And you can then use that to study the structure of these atomic orbitals. So this is something known as nuclear magnetic resonance or electron spin resonance or things like this. It's the fundamental principle behind what we do with, it's similar to the kind of thing we do for CAT scans and stuff like that in hospitals. So it has enormous applications.
So a magnetic field can change the energy.
So a magnetic field can change the energy of some of these orbitals.
Therefore, change the state or the shape.
May not change the shape, but it will. It can change energies, and that can cause spectral lines to happen where there weren't any before. And so this is what you study. All right, so we may come back to that, but
so let's step back now and talk about atoms in general, because I guess I missed the bottom line there. So you can take a spherically symmetric potential, put it in Schrodinger's equation, solve it exactly, get this craziness, and start looking at what the differences in energies are and what the characteristics of this thing are, and you get exactly the hydrogen. It is one of the most miraculous, or it's hard to call it miraculous, I mean, people really worked and made it happen. But it is hugely amazing advance in science. If you go and you measure the positions of these spectral lines that you expect to see in hydrogen, you see very little discrepancy with the actual numbers that you get out that junior physics majors can calculate exactly on their homework assignments.
If we can do it like independently of each atom, can we do it collectively, like for one mass, like human or like?
Well, so there's a lot in that. If we can do it independently for each atom, so that's the next step, because it's much more complicated. Once I throw in other electrons, life is very complicated. So what we actually can solve exactly would be atoms where there's a single electron, because that's a fully spherical, symmetric, two-body problem. I might have different atoms, so I could have a hydrogen atom, which really means I have just a proton in the center. I could have a helium atom, which means I have two protons and two neutrons, but it's really just a charged two center. So it's the same thing, basically, physics-wise, so long as I have only one electron. So it only works for an atom where we've removed one of the electrons, because helium normally comes in two electrons. The minute I throw in another electron, it's a very complicated potential or force. Because now, if I have an electron here, it will feel the force of the nucleus, but it will also feel the force of the other electron. And I don't really know where that other electron is. So life is very complicated all of a sudden. And I can't solve that exactly. So that's... You can make approximations, you can... But let's first see if we can really understand the states that a single electron would be in for different atoms, and then we can think a little bit about how we might populate those states if we had more complicated things. So,
generally speaking, an atom has a nucleus. The nucleus has a size of about 10 to the minus 15 meters. And we say that we have Z protons and A minus Z neutrons. All right. Z is the generic variable name that we give to the number of positive charges in the nucleus. So there is evidence of a fairly heavy particle that exists inside the nucleus, which we call the proton. Each proton has one positive charge. For reasons that we'll talk about in a minute, the number of positive charges you have in the center of the nucleus determines the element that you're talking about. If you have one positive charge, it's hydrogen. If you have two positive charges, it's helium. If you have three positive charges, it's lithium. Okay? If you have 92, it's uranium. In addition to that, there is a heavy particle which exists in the nucleus. And there's a whole story behind the discovery of each of these things. We're probably not going to integrate that. But there are some number of neutral particles that also exist in this. Could be zero, could be lots. And these are known as neutrons. And neutrons actually are very similar to protons, they just lack the electric charge. Their mass is slightly different, but they're very similar. So we say that the atomic mass of the nucleus, generally is the number of protons and neutrons. So A is known as the sort of atomic mass, and it's equal to the number of protons plus number of neutrons. So that's why A minus Z is going to be the number of neutrons. I can have an atom of a certain element, like an atom of hydrogen, where I have one proton, that's what makes a hydrogen, and I can have different numbers of neutrons. If I have one neutron, we call it deuterium, but it's really just hydrogen with a neutron. If I have two neutrons, we call it tritium. It's just hydrogen with two neutrons. And sometimes the characteristics of these beasts can be quite different. Tritium is unstable, radioactive. You don't want to breathe it when you do the difference. Hydrogen would be okay. Just don't light it up. You know, so you can have different numbers of neutrons for the same number of protons, and you basically have the same type of atom. It has different nuclear characteristics, but it has similar chemical characteristics. So if we have same number protons differing number of neutrons, these things are said to be isotopes of each other. So deuterium is an isotope of hydrogen. Tritium is an isotope of hydrogen. In general, atoms themselves are neutral. So if I have Z protons, I will have filling orbitals not so different from the ones that I showed you. I'll have Z electrons. So this would be if we have a neutral atom. If I remove one or more of the electrons so that I have a net electric charge on the thing, or if I add an electron to an atom more than its complement of Z, then it has a net charge, and we call those things ions. So this is sort of the basic structure of an atom. And regardless of Z, I can take Schrodinger's equation and I can calculate the orbitals that exist for that atom if I have it with only one electron. I can calculate it exactly. So what that means is that I can sort of imagine that I can calculate the states of existence that the electrons could fill for any atom. And so then the question is sort of for a first approximation as to what a more complicated atom would look like would be to say, here's the nucleus. It basically sets up these houses as possibilities for the electrons to go in. And then now instead of one electron, I have 15 electrons. How do I distribute them among these houses or orbitals? And so there's a way of doing that. So in this case, you can sort of imagine having a more complicated ski village, right? And now I have a whole pile of people that come up in the bus, and then how do they get distributed amongst these houses? And it's sort of a complicated way of looking at things, but you can have one person go into the lowest energy state, and there is a degree of freedom that we'll talk about called spin, which actually allows two particles to occupy the same space, basically. So you can put a couple in this house, and then other people come along, they come to this house, and basically that couple says, we're sleeping here, you've got to move on. So they then have to go up to the next energy state. And it turns out there are three houses there. They have geometrically different shapes, but they take the same energy to go into. And you can now distribute three couples at that energy, and then three couples at the next energy. So this is sort of a game you can play. And so what you find is with these atoms is they get more complicated. If you have more electrons, you basically fill these orbitals up, or the shells, we call them. And there are basic rules that allow you to do it. One of the things that we find is that we'll talk more about this, I don't want to go off on a tangent on it right now. Electrons are a type of particle that exhibit a characteristic which we call spin, which is half integral. What that means we'll talk about, so don't worry about it too much. But it turns out that particles that have that, you cannot have more than one in a single quantum state. So spin you can think of a little bit as like a magnet that has a direction. So it turns out that we have all of these available quantum states, each of which can only take one electron, which isn't quite right because the spin can be oriented one way or the other. So it turns out that each of these states can take two electrons. But when it's filled, I can't put another particle in there. And so what that means is as you get to more complicated atoms, the electrons have to populate houses that are further away from this core that's attracting them. So you get lots of implications out of that. If an electron occupies an orbital where the density of it usually has it further away from the nucleus
then the higher energy, then the energy, then the electrons in the lower energy states. This electron that's normally out here is going to feel the positive attraction of the nucleus. But in addition, there will be the negative repulsion from all of the electrons that spend most of their time closer to the nucleus. So this outer shell electron is going to be held less tightness, for example. So that means it would be easier to remove that electron. If I have another nucleus over here that likes to absorb electrons, then it may take this electron and form an overall less energetic state. And that's, this might then be left being positive, this would then be negative, and they might attract each other. That's basically what salt is. If you have sodium and you have chloride, chlorine will basically strip an electron off the sodium. They now have different charges and they attract each other, and you have something totally different. Sodium is a metal that if you throw it in a commode, it will explode. It's a highly reactive metal. It's so reactive because it turns out to have an electron that's sitting out that's easier to pull off. Chlorine gas is a yellowish gas that you don't ever want to breathe. You can make it if you want to throw some acid in Clorox. I don't recommend you do it unless you want to. I did it in high school because I was bored teaching chemistry. I did a lot of stuff. You can't have nearly as much fun with chemistry these days as I did. I'd be one of those guys they had in jail for making black powder and teaching chemistry, which I did. I smoked up an entire building. My chemistry professor was like an assistant coach in the football team, so he was always out coaching the football players, and we sort of had the run of all the chemicals. Thank God we didn't kill ourselves or anybody else. And it wasn't like we were wanting to make a bomb or anything like that. It was just really stupid. Ooh, it'll blow up. Cool. Boom. It was sort of like... Anyway, so I make chlorine gas, which you can do by dumping acid in Clorox. And Henry, don't ever use it. It's not good for you. But it's very different. So sodium and chlorine are really very different things. But when you put the atoms together and you have this exchange of the electron, one, you'll release a lot of energy, and you create something totally different, which is a molecule of sodium chloride or salt. So chemistry is really nothing more than a rearrangement of electrons within these orbitals. So when you figure out the rules of how the electrons in the more complex atoms fill up these orbitals and how tightly they're held and what their energies are, you basically then have the explanation for what makes different elements reactive and which ones not. And it basically explains chemistry at some level. All right, so in fact, in my thinking, I did want to start thinking a little bit about spin. I'll come back and write a lot of stuff on this particular slide, I think. But for now, if you really want to see how the electrons populate the orbitals, we have to face the fact that there was a surprise that was discovered in 1922. The so-called Stern-Gerlach experiment. It was known that if you have atoms with electrons in them, you can think of them as electric charge. I don't think we studied it very much, but if I take an electric current and I put it in a circle, it'll create a magnetic field. So if I have just a little current loop like this, it will act just like a little ball mill. Okay? And so people had discovered that atoms could have magnetic fields just like little bar magnets. And we say that they have net spin in the atom if they do that. Okay? And a way to think about it, a way to visualize it, is that you could just sort of imagine, and this is the classical way of looking at it, you can sort of imagine the electron is this sort of charged cloud that rotates or something, and it would create a magnetic field that would look a little bit like a bar magnet. So if you have a little bar magnet and you have a beam of these things, so you have a beam of atoms that have a net spin, and you put them through a big magnetic field, especially if it's a little bit non-uniform, there'll be a force on this particle. So your beam will actually bend in this thing. Stern and Gerlach created a set of atoms that were such that they knew them to have zero spin. So what that means is you might imagine I maybe have an electron cloud that rotates one way and another that rotates the other way, and they basically cancel each other out. So in the ground state of certain atoms, they knew that this was the case. And they then sent this beam through a non-uniform magnetic field, and what they found was the beam of atoms was split into two. And this was a massive surprise to them, because the atom itself should have had net magnetic characteristics of zero. They had one electron. You can sort of think of it as having one electron in there. I mean, it was multiple electrons, but it had one that it had odd number of electrons, so there was one sort of unpaired. But the net spin for the atom should have been zero. And what they found was when they sent beams of the atoms through this non-uniform magnetic field, it split in two. What this meant was that the electron itself acts as if it has spin. So not only do you think of sort of an atom potentially having spin, that is, having a charge distribution around it, which may be rotating and create something like a little magnetic field, what they discovered in 1922 was that atoms themselves, what we think of as these point-like particles or these waves, have intrinsic spin to them. So it's almost as if, even though this doesn't agree at all with either really the particle picture or the wave picture, you could almost think of each electron as being something of a spherical charge distribution that rotates. And it can either rotate one way or the other way. So there were, when this atomic beam was split into two, it was equivalent to saying, I can spin one way or the other way. And mathematically, the way that that is thought about is that you could sort of think of it as a little bar magnet of a certain strength that could be oriented this way or that way relative to the magnetic field. And under those circumstances, we would say that the particle has a spin one half, where the spin could be oriented one half up or one half down. Where the one half come from, I don't know, it makes a lot of sense. But it turns out that particles that have half integral spin, that is, they have, so all particles potentially have spin. They do not all have spin. Some have zero spin, some have spin one half, some have spin one, or whatever it is. A way to think about that is if they have zero spin, it's as if they have no magnetic characteristics. If they have spin one half, it's as if they're a bar magnet. If they have spin one, it's as if their bar magnet is twice as strong. But it also means that in a magnetic field, some can be oriented one way, some can be oriented the other way, and you can have some come to a zero. So it gets sort of complicated. It turns out that when you ask things like, how many particles can fit into a single quantum state, particles that have half integral spin and particles that have integral spin are completely different. So if particles have half integral spin, they cannot share quantum states. So as you put electrons, since electrons have half integral spin, as you populate an atom, if I put a particle in the lowest energy state, I can put another particle, another electron in the lowest energy state if it has opposite spin, but I now can't put any more in that state at all. If particles have integral spin, so 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, it turns out I can put an infinite number of them in the same quantum state. So they just turn out to be very different types of particles. Particles with half integral spin are called fermions. Particles with integral spin are called bosons. We're going to go through this more. I don't promise it will make a lot more sense to you on some level, but it does have some pretty strong implications. And you know, why does the universe have bosons and fermions? Don't know. Some people believe there's a fundamental symmetry in the universe called supersymmetry, and we'll talk a little bit about, which hypothesizes that there is an exact symmetry between bosons and fermions, for whatever reason. So we'll come back to this, but one of the reasons I'm dragging you through at the moment is the physical characteristics of it are very different. What an atom would look like if electrons were bosons is all the electrons would be in the bottom ground state. You wouldn't have spectroscopy, you wouldn't have chemistry, it would be a very strange world. The fact that you fill the shells of the electron, you can only put the two electrons in each of these houses, if you will, you have very different rich specific structure for each type of atom. And this is what leads to the richness of chemistry. This is why sodium is highly reactive and neon is not reactive at all. It gives you the entire periodic chart can basically be explained by how these electrons fill these atoms. I'm done. Out of time. Have a good weekend.